fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down at the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November turn gloomy. Lake Huron rolls, Superior sings in the rooms of her ice water mansion. Old Michigan steams like a young man's dreams. The islands and bays are for sportsmen. And farther below, Lake Ontario takes in what Lake Erie can send her. The iron boats go as the mariners all know, with the gales of November remembered.
Today on Route 51, we look at an extraordinary summer adventure. A man and his three sons who kayaked all the way around Lake Superior, a 1,500-mile circumnavigational trip, braving the lake's frigid waters and unpredictable and unforgiving weather patterns, surviving on wilderness beaches and makeshift shelters on a journey to raise money for children in Africa, children infected with the HIV virus, many of them orphans, children living along the shores of another great lake, the second largest lake in the world, Lake Victoria. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today we welcome into our Wisconsin Public Radio studios an exceptional family, Joe Bodavis of Minocqua and his sons, 14-year-old Will, 12-year-old Luke, and 10-year-old Noah. Now, today's conversation will be about people in need and also about this great wilderness lake that stretches across our northern border in the shores of the Upper Peninsula, Minnesota, and the province of Ontario. We'd like to know if Lake Superior is a special place for you. Have you ever kayaked its waters? Have you taken a boat on those frigid waters and encountered weather patterns that have, maybe made you concerned about your own safety? Have you ever made the trip all the way around the lake, whether by boat or by car? If so, we want to hear from you. Please give us a call to join the conversation at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. So it's Joe, Will, Luke, and Noah Bodavis. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Glenn, thanks for having us.
Yep. Joe, tell us a little bit about yourself and your family. We understand you're a veterinarian in Minocqua.
That's correct. We have a practice in Minocqua, Wisconsin. We actually live in Hazelhurst, and I have five children. These are my three boys, or the oldest, and we spend a lot of time up in the woods up around our house and a lot of time exploring the wild country up there and Lake Superior. And it kind of led into this trip for us. It's one of our favorite places, as it is for a lot of people that live up near its shore.
It's definitely one of my favorite places, too, and that's one of the reasons I was so interested in doing this show. Now, Joe, I met you a year and a half ago, and I also met two of your boys who are with us, Luke and Noah, on a scientific expedition coordinated by the DNR in which you helped replace a radio collar on a hibernating mother bear in the Wausau area. You served as the anesthesiologist. We'll be playing that tape a little bit later in the show. Is that something that you have an opportunity to do quite a bit working as a veterinarian up in the North Woods?
Well, I'm fortunate that I have some friends and acquaintances that I've developed over the years that work both with the DNR and the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and I really enjoy the opportunity to do that. With my boys, it's been a great opportunity. One of the provisions for these guys that I work with is that I always get to take my kids along. So we don't hesitate to take them out of school and educate them out in the field, and this was a great opportunity for these boys. In fact, even Noah's picture on our website has a picture of him holding the baby bear that was there at that on that little trip we did that day.
Oh, I had a chance to do that too, and it was just amazing. And again, we'll play some of that sound a little bit later in the program today. But what gave you the idea to go on this adventure all the way around Lake Superior? Is that something you've ever done before?
Well, about 15 years ago, before we had any children, I had an opportunity to take an expedition where I did a solo trip. I started on my bicycle in Vancouver and went across Canada, and then I kayaked about across the boundary waters, North Shore, Lake Superior, and Lake Huron, and then I biked the rest of the way to Yarmouth, Nova Scotia. So that was about 120 days. That was back before children, but I was so impressed with the North Shore, Lake Superior that I vowed to myself at that point that if I had ever had an opportunity to take my children, that I would. And we've been talking about this for several years, in earnest for about the last year. It took about a year of planning.
Will, what did you think about this this whole expedition?
I really liked the whole thing. It was a great experience for me, and I thought it was great, and I'm glad we did it.
You know, it's something that most 14-year-olds really don't have an opportunity to do, let alone 12-year-olds like you, Luke. What did you think of it?
I thought it was a great trip. Enjoyed every second or most of it. There's a couple downtimes, but the trip in general was one of the greatest things that I've ever done.
And 10-year-old Noah, I mean, it goes without saying that if you're 10 years old, you don't have much of an opportunity, if you're most people, to go on that trip of a lifetime.
It was a really fun trip, and I liked it because I got to be out in the woods and out in the weather and see what Lake Superior was like, so I really liked the trip a lot.
You get tired out?
Yeah, I did a little bit, but I'm surprised I didn't get that sore. So I didn't sleep that bad. We got up at 5 o'clock in the morning, so it was kind of hard to get some sleep. But yeah, I didn't get really tired at all, not much.
Your kids must be in real good shape, Joe.
Well, they are. It was funny, as the trip went on, we started out doing about 15 miles a day, and then as it progressed, at the end they were doing 30 miles a day. They were getting stronger, and I was getting tireder. So I think had we gone much longer, they would have been towing me in. So fortunately, we were able to complete it on time.
How long did this trip take, and how long did you think it was going to take?
We had planned for a total of up to 85 days. It only took us 73. We made good time. We had planned for 17 windbound days, and we were only windbound 12. And so at the end, because the boys were paddling from dawn to dusk for the last several weeks, we made up a lot of time. Because there again, they had gotten so strong that they just kept paddling.
Let's talk about the cause behind this. You decided to raise money for HIV-infected children in Africa. How did that come about?
I had an opportunity about 10 years ago when these children were young, and I was in visiting my sister in Tanzania, and I spent a couple days at an orphanage there that was very desperate, didn't have a lot of money. We had kept contact with those children and the lady that was running the orphanage over the years. We've been sending them some money every Christmas. And so the boys came to me as we were doing this trip and thought maybe this was an opportunity to raise some awareness. And so Will worked on a website and put it together and contacted the lady, and we got photos of the kids. And we thought it was a good cause. And they've so far raised a little over $2,000 for the children there.
This is the Mary Knowles Sisters HIV Orphanage Program?
Yes, there's a lady there, Sister Marion Hughes, who I met that runs the, she does it on her own through Mary Knowles. And actually, this is from funds outside of Mary Knowles. She does it as a side project. These children are anywhere between the ages of 1 and 15, 16. And there's about 20 of them in the orphanage right now. Many of these children will never live to the age of my boys, and they're desperately poor, and they've lost their parents. And
how do they end up being HIV positive at that young age?
These children are all born with it, and the HIV rate in women in Africa right now is extremely high, so these children are born with it. And some of them live to be 10 to 12. Often they rarely live to be 20 before the AIDS virus explodes out of their body, and then they don't live long after that.
And if people want to find out more, you've got a website. It's kidspaddleforacause.com. That's kidspaddleforacause, all one word, .com.
That's correct. Will did that as one of his school projects, and he put that together for us. And we also have a blog there that you can link onto that gives a daily log of what we did, more detail about the trip as well.
Will, was that a challenge for you, putting together that website?
Sometimes it wasn't. My dad had sort of helped me out with some of the scripts and stuff or what to say. But I thought it turned out a lot better than I ever thought it would.
Well, it's a real professional-looking website, and I was surprised when I found out that, just because you're 14 years old, were the person behind it. You should be really proud of what you've accomplished. These orphan kids, the HIV-infected kids, live along the shores of Lake Victoria, which is the second largest lake in the world.
That's correct. Lake Victoria is the second largest surface area. Superior is the first. Lake Baikal's got the most volume in Russia, but it's the seventh largest surface area. So they live along the shore there. Some of them swim in the lake. They're familiar with the lake. Unfortunately, there's a parasite there called bilharzia, and if you somebody like me were to swim in the lake, would probably get infected, and it can cause some severe liver and kidney issues. Many of these children do get those infections. And, of course, if they're HIV positive, that's a compounding factor already.
So you decided to do a fundraising trip, kayaking all the way around the largest lake in the world in order to help HIV-infected children who live along the shores of the second largest lake.
That's correct. We thought it was fitting and it helped raise awareness, too. I think sometimes in our daily news we forget about the desperate plight of children around the world, and particularly in Africa. And this was an opportunity that we recognize these children over there will never have anything close to this, let alone a family. But the opportunity to do something like this. So I think it helped inspire these boys. And I think there were many times when times were tough and things were down and the weather was terrible, that it inspired them to keep them going, realizing that they were able to do something that many children will never get the chance to do.
And again, that website is kidspaddleforacause.com. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51. We're talking to a pretty amazing family, Joe Bodavis, who helped his three sons, 14-year-old Will, 12-year-old Luke, and 10-year-old Noah, on a circumnavigational trip all around Lake Superior in order to raise money for HIV-infected kids in Africa. We're taking your phone calls at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. And we'll be back to talk about the trip around Lake Superior right after this.
Support for WPR comes from Rely Local Wausau, working to build the local economy and strengthen the community by making local business everybody's business. Learn more about locally owned and operated businesses at relylocal.com.
This is Route 51. We're talking to Joe Bodavis and his three boys, 14-year-old Will, 12-year-old Luke, and 10-year-old Noah, about their 1,500-mile trip by kayak all the way around Lake Superior. Boys, what was your previous experience kayaking? This certainly wasn't the first time you've done anything like that. Will, we'll start with you, and we'll just go down the line here to Luke and Noah.
Well, we had taken a lot of canoe trips, which is sort of like kayaking, but we had owned some like knock-around kayaks, and my dad had done a kayaking trip, as he told you about, on the North Shore. So then we got some kayaks, and we went up to on Lake Superior to the Apostle Islands, and we kayaked around the sea caves and stuff like that, and yeah, that was.
So Luke, this is nothing new for you, and get right on top of that microphone when you're talking to me.
No, not really. We did do a bunch of canoe trips, like Will said, and also we went up to the Apostle Islands and did a trip up there for like 3 days, and then we also did a sea caves trip, all with our good boats, because it would be nearly impossible to do a three-day trip on Lake Superior with knock-around kayaks.
And Noah, you're 10 years old. You must have, were you a little bit scared to go on this trip?
Yeah, I was scared in a few times, but not very much. It was a fun trip, but there was some scary and hard parts on it. There's one time when there's a sailboat guy. He ran at our bow and stern like three times. He was like coming right at us a lot, so that was one of the scary times for me. But other than that, there when we crossed back Black's Bay, that was another scary time.
When you crossed what?
Black's Bay.
Where is that, Joe?
Well, Black's Bay is a little bit east of Thunder Bay, and it's about a 7-mile crossing. And as we were coming across there, it was kind of windy, and the wind died down, so we decided to cross. And when we got out into the main channel, it was about a 30-mile stretch of where the wind could run north to south, and it picked up, so it kicked up some 5-foot whitecaps. Since we were trying to travel across from that, they were broaching us on the side. So it, as a father, I was a little nervous. Noah was a little nervous. We were paddling hard, and of course I looked over several times and saw Will with his legs up outside of the kayak stretching, so I don't think he was nervous at all. But we had a few of those, and Noah did have one time we came around a point at Whitefish, the infamous Whitefish Point, and we had some great big waves breaking over the top of the sandbar there, and he took a couple 7-footers over the top of his head.
Oh, but, boy.
He came out and asked to do it again, so I guess he wasn't that scared, but I was a little nervous at that point.
So you had a choice there to go around the shore, but you decided to cut in right across the bay because the weather was was cooperating at the time.
Yeah, actually, we made about 30 crossings that were 3 miles or more in length, and that was at where most of the danger was, because with the water being so cold, it was 38 degrees all the way up until about January 22nd, then it started to warm. So once we got a little ways away from shore, we ran the risk of if we capsized, but we had to, because if you follow the shore completely, the trip gets so long. So we cut off Black's Bay, which was would have saved us 60 to 65 miles of paddling by making a 7-mile crossing. So we had that happen a lot during the trip.
How do you feel in the middle of that crossing, Noah, when the wind picked up like that?
Well, I was pretty scared because I was wondering if you're going to capsize, but it was a 3-mile crossing, so if it capsized, you'd have to get inside your boat or else you would get hypothermia. So it was pretty dangerous, but after we got through it, it was pretty easy for a while because Thunder Bay was a lot better than Black's Bay. It picked up in the beginning, but then it died down towards the end, so we didn't have any problems there.
What did you have to do to prepare in terms of the supplies that you brought with you, Joe?
Well, we were fortunate that my wife, Molly, and my two daughters, Christina and Lana, met us about every 14 days, and they resupplied us with about 150 pounds of food. We had spent the year drying our own food, preparing our own food. They would also bring a change of clothes. We didn't change clothes very often. We didn't bathe very often. I think we lost the soap about day four and the toothbrush bag somewhere along the way. So, what's happier
than... You carried ivory soap with you, didn't you?
Well, we had a little, yeah.
It floats, you know. If you drop it in the lake, you can find it.
I don't know who lost it, but it wasn't me. But what better than...
Will is pointing at you right now, Joe.
Three adolescent boys with 73 days, and they don't have to take a bath with mom not there to make them take a bath and wash their hair. So, but Molly did that, and had she not done that, we wouldn't have been able to do it.
What kind of clothing, sleeping bags? I mean, if you're just on kayaks, you don't have a lot of room for things.
Right, we didn't have a lot of room. We wore a lot of synthetics. There's a company called Wintergreen, which we buy a lot of their products out of northern Minnesota. Wind pants and fleece, and then a lot of long underwear. It was cold the first month. It rarely got above 40, 45 degrees because we had a lot of wind coming off the lake, and at 38 degrees, I know in a lot of middle of June we had our down jackets and we would wear those, but pretty much one change of clothes and an emergency pair of long underwear in case we took a dunking.
How about radio equipment, GPS? What did you carry with you?
We didn't use a GPS. Will was our navigator with the maps and the compass. Will lost the maps one time. I lost the compass one time, but fortunately Will was able to save them both times. And he navigated the whole trip for us with map and compass. We did use a cell phone that we were able to use some of the time along the shore, and we had a satellite phone, which was their mom's one provision, that we have a satellite phone and call in every night at 7 o'clock. We also used a VHF radio, weather radio, that we could communicate with the Coast Guard in case of an emergency.
And that was my next question. Your wife, Molly, is either a saint or she must have been scared to death for the four of you, or maybe both.
Well, she's pretty used to it. You know, it was when we were leaving, it was cute, and I was trying to tell her in so many words that I would bring them all back or I wouldn't be coming back, and she knows me, and she just cut me off, and she said, "You always come back." And I guess I've been kicking around in third world countries and different places long enough that I've always brought them back.
Lake Superior is so cold. Did you ever get hypothermia? Did you ever worry that you might have to find some medical attention?
No, we never had. Actually, other than a couple bad cases of poison ivy, we never broke out the first aid kit. These kids were amazingly healthy and strong. We had a good balanced diet, and coupling that with the exercise, we didn't never had any problems with hypothermia.
What did you eat?
Well, I think, let's think. Luke, what was your favorite thing? These guys can probably tell you.
Well, my favorite thing by far was our homemade burritos, which were... basically bean and cheese burritos with anything else.
Well, Tabasco sauce. That was
key. Oh, yeah. Me
there
and my
you
dad
go. That'll keep you warm.
Me and my dad love Tabasco sauce. Anything that I wasn't too fond of, I would put Tabasco sauce on.
And Will, what did you... Will liked it.
My favorite thing was my dad's homemade pizza bagels, which was his invention, and we basically put sauce on bagels and then cooked them up in the skillet and put some cheese on it. And
Noah, what was your favorite food?
Well, like Will said, I like the pizza bagels, and there was some pretty good mac and cheese, too. So
And we stopped about every 2.5 hours to feed them. What I found with the boys is that it wasn't fatigue so much as hunger. So we had about 5 meals a day. We'd break the stove out early in the morning and then at dinner, and then during the day we would eat a lot of granola bars and a lot of bagels.
You have a Coleman stove with you, or did you have to start a fire every time to get heat for the food?
We used a white gas stove, a little one-burner whisper light, and then we would build fires. The boys like to build fires. In fact, in the evening when we get in, that was a lot of fun for them to build a little fire and have some popcorn or something like that.
And Will, you were the navigator.
Yep.
How do you learn how to operate with a compass and chart your way with maps?
Well, it took quite a bit of practice. We only got lost a couple times. But you just sort of, like, it will, like, it on the map, it shows you, like, where it is and then pointing north. So you just sort of follow the shore and just hope you're at the right spot.
We did have one case there where a fog bank blew in a big crossing. And we saw it coming and the wind picking up. And Will was able to take a bearing, and we paddled for almost an hour. And we hit this little island out in the middle of this crossing. I don't know how he did it, because according to my directions, we missed it. But we peered out of the fog, and we sat out the fog and the wind, and then we were able to paddle on. So, yeah, he really got really good at it, better than I was.
Jobo Davis and his sons, Will, Luke, and Noah, a 1,500-mile circumnavigational trip around Lake Superior. Do you love Lake Superior like the four of us in this studio do? Give us a call at 1-800-780-9742.
Support for WPR comes from UMR, a United Healthcare company providing employee benefits administration, integrated health management, and pharmacy benefits administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More at umr.com.
We're back on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio with the Jobo Davis family. Joe from Minocqua with his three sons, 14-year-old Will, 12-year-old Luke, and 10-year-old Noah, who circumnavigated by kayak the 1,500-mile trip around Lake Superior. They did it this past summer in order to raise money for HIV-infected children in Africa. You can find out more at their website, kidspaddleforacause.com. We're talking about that trip around Lake Superior. We're talking about Lake Superior itself, the cold, frigid beauty of the world's largest lake, the lake which was considered sacred by the Chippewa. And we're asking you to call us with your impressions of Lake Superior, and especially if you've been on a boat in the middle of the lake, if you've kayaked it, or if you've done the trip all the way around Lake Superior, whether by boat or by car. Let's go to the phones right now. We have Tom in Rhinelander. Tom, you're on Route 51 with the Bodavis family. Hello, Tom.
Well, thank you very much, and I want to congratulate them on a great trip and a great cause. I just love Lake Superior. I have a cabin up in the watershed, and I've canoed the lake and canoed partway around Isle Royale, visited the Slate Islands, fished the tributaries, whitewater kayak the tributaries, and the whole place is just magical. And without being hypercritical, I did want to make one comment, though, about the floating ivory soap. When I was growing up, we used to go to lakes and bathe with the soap in the lakes, and it was always ivory because it floated. And I've just come to believe that it's polluting a lake to put soap in it. It's hard on the insect life, hard on the fish, and I think just really disrespectful of the great place that Lake Superior is. So, again, not criticizing your guests, but just trying to make a pitch to everyone out there that if you're using a lake or a stream, don't use it like a bathtub.
Well, actually, Tom, I agree with you. We actually didn't bathe in the lake. When we bathed, we would take the water up away from the shore about 100 feet, and we would do that. We would jump in the lake and get wet, and then we would rinse from water from the lake. But we actually don't even use any soap for our dishes. We just use the sand, and we agree with you 100%. We live on a lake, and I'm a big fan of keeping all the soap out of the lake.
Well, that's wonderful. And, again, way to go. It sounds like you had a great trip, and it was for a great cause. So thanks for being in the air and sharing it with us.
And, Tom, I'm the one who made the flippant remark about ivory soap floating. It was a joke, looking back at it, it's something that I wish I hadn't said, and thanks for making the point. It's a point well made.
Well, again, thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you, Tom.
Okay. Bye.
The three of you traversed hundreds of miles of wilderness beaches. How did you survive at night? What shelter did you find? Did you make your own shelters?
Well, actually, we primarily used tents. However, Will took quite a notion. He had a book about building shelters, and he made quite a few shelters along the shore out of driftwood and branches, dead material along the way, and he slept in those a couple times. The bugs were pretty wicked a little bit later in the summer. There was a lot of no-see-ums and the mosquitoes. So we primarily did it in the tent. We would try to find an area. We tried to camp below the storm line, but above the obviously high water mark. That way, when the storms come in, they'll take all traces away. We really do, as Tom was saying, we really tried to do a as minimal impact as we could, and so we found that the tents, other than the driftwood shelters, were the way to go.
What was it like making those shelters, Will?
Well, you never knew exactly how it would go. I mean, sometimes you'd put together the last log and it all collapsed from right underneath. Right next to you, but it was still a challenge, and it was pretty fun. Gave me something to do.
And Luke and Noah, what's it like sleeping on the beach on Lake Superior at night?
I thought it was rather comfortable. I think first couple nights I didn't really get used to the waves. It was kind of annoying me, but after a while, I felt like it was part of sleeping, and really enjoyed it, and tents were fairly easy to set up, even though I did get stuck with a rather complicated tent that I didn't really agree with, but it is big enough, and it worked.
Noah, were you able to sleep well at night out in the woods, out in the wild, right on the shore of Lake Superior?
Yeah, I slept pretty well, actually. The thermos, you get used to it after a few days. It's not too bad. So when I got back and I pushed my elbow into my bed, I'm like, that's not, I thought it was so hard on the trip, but when I came back, it seemed really soft compared to that thin therm rest I had. But you didn't really usually feel the rocks, you just felt, it was just like laying on a flat surface with a therm rest.
We got to the point where we hated sand. Sand was nice for pulling your boat up, but sand would get in everything, in your sleeping bag, in your stove. Was constantly taking the stove apart and cleaning the sand out. Will one night did have a visitor during the night. Normally our nights were pretty quiet. I had a run-in with a group of drunks, hooligans, as we like to call them, one night as they were lit our one of Will's shelters on fire. And we're in our kayaks, but I was able to convince them with some mild persuasion that they should move on, and that turned out okay. But Will did have a visitor one night of a different sort, and he might want to tell you about that.
Yeah, one night we had just crossed in the middle of a fog to an island called Batchewana Island, and we had camped there. And anyways, I awoke to the sound of like a bow, 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 sound like that, and it was a little baby porcupine that was right next to my tent and was either lost or something. He was looking for his mom or something, and I called back to him, so I opened up my tent, and he's like right next to my tent flap. His little baby was really cool.
So all night long, that little baby porcupine was circling around his tent, calling for his mother. He thought Will was his mother trying to get in his tent, but we got some cute pictures from it. Anyway.
You guys see any bears while you were out there?
No, actually we didn't. You know, we talked. A lot of people ask about the wildlife. Will went out one morning and came face to face with a cow moose and her baby. He was out actually looking for a moose, and he found one. Mm-hmm. We saw a lot of foxes. We did see a wolf along the shore, but because of the noise of the waves and the fact that it's such a sterile shoreline with cold water, there's not a lot of food along the shore, and I think the waves mm-hmm. tend to scare the animals. Most of the animals that we saw were when we would hike in a little ways, but right along the shore we didn't see a whole lot. A lot of loons, many, many loons, and gulls and cormorants, but not a lot of wildlife other than foxes. And we saw a lot, but not every day did we see something.
Once we even got to see a wolf, we were paddling along, and we looked up on the shore, and there's a wolf just trotting down the shore. And we called to it, and it didn't respond, like we whistled. So we knew it wasn't a pet, and we just watched it for a while till it kind of ran away.
We're talking to Joe Bodavis and his three boys, 14-year-old Will and 12-year-old Luke and 10-year-old Noah, who took a 1,500-mile circumnavigational trip around Lake Superior this past summer. I ran into Joe and Noah and Luke a year and a half ago when we ventured out together during an expedition by the DNR, a scientific expedition to chart the progress of black bears in Wisconsin as they moved further south. Now, Joe, as he told you in the first part of the show, is a veterinarian. He was the anesthesiologist on the trip. I'm going to play that story for you, and we're going to come back and talk about wildlife in Wisconsin.
Hey, Tim, how are you doing?
Good.
DNR Secretary Matt Frank greets the dozen or so people at a Marathon County trailhead, happy to be out of the office.
One of the best parts of the job, just getting out and seeing what everybody's working on.
What everybody's working on is replacing the radio collar on a 12-year-old female black bear that's hibernating about a mile into the woods. It's part of a study headed by Dave McFarland, research scientist with the DNR.
For the last 20 years, we've had bears moving progressively further south. What are the movement corridors? What are the likely barriers?
McFarland's research has shown that the bears are not only on the move, there are more of them. UW-Madison wildlife ecologist Tim Van Dielen says the numbers are much higher than earlier estimates.
When he predicted there were 25 or 30,000 bears, the DNR number was closer to 12 or 15,000.
The hibernating mother is at the southern edge of the state's recognized bear habitat. She was discovered 2 years ago by local hunter Terry Lane.
I was out here rabbit hunting one day and I heard something squealing, making a noise like a puppy. Turned out to be a bear, and then I knew there must have been a newborn in there.
2 years later, the bear is back and is once again a mother, nursing four newborn cubs. Anesthesiologist Joe Bodavis prepares the tranquilizer.
We'll actually use a pole that's about 6 feet long, and we'll attach a syringe to it.
The makeshift group of scientists, hunters, and volunteers trudges through high snow into a clear-cut region of the forest, led by UW-Madison researcher Carl Malcolm.
Those young clear cuts are great denning places.
The party pushes through the spindly growth to the den where the groggy mother lays with her four cubs. Bodavis plunges the syringe into her side, and soon she's asleep. The tiny cubs are pulled away and handed one at a time to the volunteers. They look like cuddly teddy bears. They sound like banshees. DNR Secretary Matt Frank takes two of the frightened cubs and holds them close inside his jacket to calm them down.
Oh, this is what it's all about. How fantastic it is that we have a state where we have a wild bear population like this that is thriving and that we're learning more about through these kind of research efforts.
You ever held two bear cubs like this out in the wild before?
This is a first, and I got to tell you, it's a thrill. It's an absolute thrill.
In the den, as Bodavis shaves the bear's neck and adjusts the new collar, Malcolm tries to extract some milk from the lactating mother.
I told him I'd give it a whirl, but I had never milked a bear before.
A request from other scientists working on a global study of bear biology.
They're really interested in trying to get some milk samples, not just from American black bears, but in fact from as many species of black bears as they could.
How do you milk a bear?
Well, I'm not quite sure. I gave it a try today, and apparently those four cubs that she has, they look really healthy and they look really plump, and that's for a reason.
With a new collar on Mama Bear and the cubs returned to her side, everyone makes a quick exit as the anesthetic wears off. Malcolm and Secretary Frank praise the cooperation between scientists and hunters that made it all possible.
They're not just out there to shoot animals. Nobody cares about these resources more than the people who are out enjoying them, and hunters are at the top of that list.
It's just great to see how this work all comes together on the ground on a day like today.
As for the four cubs, next year they'll be fitted with radio collars to help the team figure out where the state's bear population is moving and how fast. In Marathon County, I'm Glenn Mobert for Wisconsin Public Radio News.
And we're talking to the anesthesiologist on that trip, Joe Bodavis, and his three sons, Joe and Will and Luke and Noah, also circumnavigated the 1,500 miles around Lake Superior. Luke and Noah, you were on that expedition with your dad. You got to pick up the bear cubs. Noah, what did you think of that?
It was fun because I've never really held that wild black bear before, so it was a good experience for me. And the cubs are just really cute, so... And they had long claws, so they tended to scratch a little bit. But it was really fun.
What do you think of the noise they made?
It was kind of an odd noise, but I've never heard it before from a bear, but I've never really heard that noise from anywhere either. So it was really cool to hear a bear make that noise.
And Luke?
I thought it sounded like a baby pig squealing.
Yes, it did. It did indeed. Joe, you took Luke and Noah out of school for that event, but in a lot of ways, that was more of an education that they could have gotten sitting in the classroom.
That's right. My wife always says, you know, don't let school get in the way of their education. And thankfully for that, we're able to take them out from time to time and do some of those things. But I think there again, you know, a big part of this trip for these boys was highly educational. We kind of talk about the adventure of it. The reality of the trip was that we had really long days, sometimes 12, 14 hours on the water. We had heavy fog where we had to paddle close together and close to shore, and it was tedious. So we spent a lot of time talking, and they never passed up a lighthouse. We went to the Whitefish Point Museum, and they learned a lot about geography and geology along the way, so that was a good learning experience.
Now, they also set a record on this trip.
That's correct. The youngest person that had done it prior to this was 18. It's only done about once or twice a year by somebody. These boys, Will broke it for about 10 seconds as a 14-year-old. He had his own kayak. And then Luke had his own, and then he currently holds the record for his own kayak. And then Noah was in a boat with me, so he's the youngest person to ever go around.
Joe Bo Davis and his three sons, 14-year-old Will, 12-year-old Luke, 10-year-old Noah, they circumnavigated Lake Superior, and they did it to raise money for HIV-infected children in Africa. You can find out more about the trip and about the cause at their website, kidspaddleforacause.com. That's kidspaddleforacause.com. We want to hear from you. If you love Lake Superior like the four of us do, if you've kayaked on the lake, if you've taken a boat on the lake, if you've traveled around the lake either by boat or by car, give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742.
Support for WPR comes from Northwind Renewable Energy in Stevens Point, partnering with agricultural and commercial industries to invest in central Wisconsin's renewable energy future. More about the benefits of solar for business at northwindre.com.
1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to talk to Joe Bo Davis and his three boys who kayaked all the way around Lake Superior. Let's go to Jake in Wausau. Jake, you're on Route 51.
Yeah, I actually have paddled all over the United States and some other countries, and I've only dipped a paddle in Lake Superior once, and I was thoroughly impressed by it. It's kind of the big kahunas on the big lakes. I'm very impressed by your trip, guys. The big question I get after all my big trips is, what's your next big trip? So that's what I'm wondering right now. Like, what do you guys have planned next?
Well, I was hoping, if I ever can, to break the record for the youngest person to ever hike the Pacific Crest, which is the trail from Mexico to Canada.
Yep.
And it's about 3,000 miles, and it takes about 5 months. So I was hoping to be the youngest to ever do that.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah, no kidding. Ambitious group.
Well, when I think of what I wanted to do when I was 14 years old, that wasn't, unfortunately, at the top of the list. Let's go down the line here to Luke. Luke, what's your next big adventure?
Well, I'm not as adventurous as my brother, but I still would like to do some paddling on Lake Nipigon, which from what I've heard, is a very cool lake and very unpopulated. So maybe circumnavigating that. It's only 400 miles, so it wouldn't be as big as a trip as Lake Superior, but still pretty cool.
And Noah, what's on your agenda?
Well, I would like to do some like hiking in Alaska, and like Luke said, I would like to do some paddling on Nipigon, because that would be a cool trip in all that wilderness. And I wouldn't want to do something like the long 3,000 mile thing like Will, but I'd like to do some hiking in Alaska, exploring, and lots of stuff in the wilderness. So that's kind of what I want to do.
And as you can see, Jake, I've kind of opened maybe a bad door. You know, when we started this trip, I told my wife, I said, at the beginning, she asked if I was worried we wouldn't make it, and I said, no, I'm worried we might. Because now we've opened the door and raised the bar for these guys, and as you can hear, it's been one of the real benefits of doing this trip, raised their confidence level.
Yeah, I love the comment. It's only 400 miles.
Yeah, that's what happened.
Yeah, oh yeah, I know all too well. The list only keeps getting longer.
I know it.
Jake, thanks so much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you guys for doing it. It's awesome to see young people into paddle sports. There's not enough of you guys.
Well, thanks.
There you go. Now, all three of you kept your own journals and you brought sketchbooks with you. Tell us about that.
Well, we all had, like you said, kept a journal of each day, and we would, at the end of the night, if we weren't too tired, we would write down everything about the day that we found was interesting and unique. And my dad's hoping to write a book on this, if he can find a publisher. So
he's making a plug for me there. Will was also our staff photographer, and he took over 5,000 photos, so he's hoping to get some of those. We've got some, they got a magazine article coming out in Canoe and Kayak next month, and Will's working on getting an article in Sea Kayaker for me, so he's hoping to sell some of those, and these other guys kept journals too.
Yeah, I was supposed to be the official journaler, and I wanted to write a book, but after a little bit, I didn't really want to write a book anymore. I wouldn't mind writing a book, but it wasn't as high priority. But the thing about journaling is when you come in at night, it was easier at the beginning of the trip because we weren't going so long. But towards the end of the trip, it was rather hard to journal at night.
Oh, I can imagine. I imagine you were pretty tired. Let's hear from Noah. Noah, what kinds of things did you write down or sketch? Did you sketch any pictures?
Yeah, I did. I did some artwork. I kind of lost track of my journal in Minnesota, so 21 days through. So I didn't have that much of a journal.
Noah was our artist, so he actually had some really nice sketches. That was what he worked at. But they're right. The fatigue level towards the end, the last few weeks when we were going long, pretty tired at night.
What was it like kayaking past the heavy industrial cities like Duluth and Superior? Did that pose a special challenge for you?
It was very discouraging and disappointing to see what people were doing to the lake when other parts of it were so beautiful and great.
We had the problem with cities like Sault Ste. Marie and Thunder Bay and then Duluth with the shipping lanes, and we had to cross those. And we had a near miss on it with a 1,000-footer coming through across Sault Ste. Marie. They go a lot faster than we anticipated, and we had a little trouble, a strong headwind trying to get across the channel. But the fastest we ever paddled a mile was that stretch there, as that ship was kind of coming down on us, but never got that close.
I'm going to ask the three boys how this trip changed you, and just give me a sentence or two because we're running out of time here. Will, we'll start with you.
I think it changed me because, obviously, I don't think I would be – my next goal would be hiking the Pacific Crest. And it sort of, raised the bar and made me more aware of what you can do.
Luke, how about you?
Same thing. At first, I was just asking myself how long I could stay in. But towards the end, I was asking myself how long before I could finish. And I was going all out.
And Noah?
Yeah, it really told me how much I didn't know I could do is that much and what I can endure. I learned my limits on that trip. At first, I didn't think I could do that much, but after the trip, I figured out that you just if you set your mind to it, you can do it.
There you go. Joe Bo Davis and Will and Luke and Noah. Guys, thanks so much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks, man. Great experience.
And keep us abreast of your next adventures. We want to stay in touch with you guys.
Yeah. Thank you for having us.
Gives up for dead when the skies of November turn gloomy.
And again, you can learn more about their kayak trip around Lake Superior and about the HIV-infected children in Africa at their website, kidspaddleforacause.com. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Special music today by Gordon Lightfoot. Next Thursday on Route 51, we look at retirement. What can you do to plan for your next stage of life, whether it's travel, a new career, or dedication to a cause, with John Nelson, author of What Color Is Your Parachute? He'll be speaking in Wausau at a United Way-sponsored conference on the subject Tuesday, October 18th. Again, thanks for riding along with us today, or kayaking. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we are heading out of town.